The Root of the Matter reports on the controversy surrounding Julie First and Adrian Morehouse in the Cat's Whiskers studio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Cat's Whiskers.
As this is Children's Book Week, in tonight's programme you can hear Dick Kingsmith, Anne Pilling and Roger McGough talking about their favourite books.
And I hope you have pens and paper ready for the first clue in the Cat's Whiskers Castle Trail.
And with episode 2 of The Last Vampire. This week, the Hollins meet the locals.
And tonight I'll be talking to fellow sportsman, the runner Steve Cram, who is our birthday guest.
But first, Roger McGough joins us to read from his book, The Stowaways.
When I lived in Liverpool, my best friend was a boy called Midge. Kevin Midgley was his real name, but we called him Midge for short. And he was short, only about 3 cornflake packets high, empty ones at that. No 3 ways about it. Midge was my best friend, and we had lots of things in common. Things we enjoyed doing, like climbing trees, playing footy, going to the pictures, hitting each other really hard. But there was one thing that really bound us together. One thing we had in common. A love of the sea. In the old days, but not that long ago, the River Mersey was far busier than it is today. Those were the days of the great passenger liners and cargo boats. My father had been to sea, and so had all my uncles and my grandfather. 6'6", muscles rippling in the wind, huge hands grappling with the helm, rum-soaked and fierce as a wounded shark. And that was my grandmother. In my bedroom each night, I used to lie in bed. Best place to lie, really. I used to lie there, especially in winter, and listen to the foghorns being sounded all down the river. I could picture the ship nosing its way out of the docks, into the channel, and out into the Irish Sea. It was exciting. Midge and I knew what we wanted to do when we left school. Become sailors. A captain, an admiral, perhaps one day even a steward. Of course, we were only about 7 or 8 at the time, so we thought we'd have a long wait. But oddly enough, the call of the sea came sooner than we'd expected. It was a Wednesday, if I remember rightly. I never liked Wednesdays for some reason. I could never spell it for a start, and it always seemed to be raining, and there were still 2 days to go before the weekend. Anyway, Midge and I got into trouble at school. I don't remember what for. Something trivial, I suppose, like chewing gum in class, or forgetting how to read, or setting fire to the music teacher. I forget now. And of course, to make matters worse, my mum and dad were in right mood when I got home. So that night in bed, I decided. Yeah, you've guessed it. I could hear the big ships calling out to each other as they sidled out of the Mersey into the oceans beyond. That's it. We'd run away to sea. Midge and I. I'd tell him the good news in the morning. The next 2 days just couldn't pass quickly enough for us. We had decided to begin our amazing around-the-world voyage on Saturday morning, so that in case we didn't like it, we were back in time for school on Monday. As you can imagine, there was a lot to think about. What clothes to take, how much food and drink. I read somewhere that sailors lived off rum and dry biscuits. So I poured some of me dad's into an empty pop bottle and borrowed a handful of half-coated chocolate digestives. I also packed me Lone Star cap gun and Midge settled for a magnifying glass. On Friday night, we met round at his house to make the final plans. We hid all the stuff in the shed in the yard and arranged to meet outside his back door next morning at the crack of dawn. Sure enough, Saturday morning, when the big finger was on 12 and the little one was on 6, Midge and I met with our little bundles under our arms and ran up the street as fast as our tiptoes could carry us. Hardly anyone was about, and the streets were so quiet and deserted, except for a policeman who eyed us suspiciously. "Hello, hello, hello," he said. "And where are you two going so early in the morning?" "Fishing," I said. Train spotting, said Midge. And we looked at each other.
I see. Just as long as you're not running away to sea.
Oh, no, 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 we chorused. Just as if. He winked at us.
Off you go, then. And remember, look both ways before crossing your eyes.
We ran off and straight down onto the landing stage, where a lot of ships were tied up. There was no time to lose, because already quite a few were putting out to sea. Then I noticed a small ship just to the left, where the crew were getting ready to cast off. They were so busy doing their work, it was easy for Midge and me to slip on board unnoticed. We looked around for somewhere to hide. Then I spotted them, the lifeboats. Quick, let's climb into one of those. They'll never look in there. Not unless we run into icebergs anyway. So, in we climbed. And no sooner had we covered ourselves with the tarpaulin, then there was a great shuddering, and the whole ship seemed to turn round on its side. We were off. Soon we'd be digging for diamonds in the Brazilian jungle, or building sandcastles on a tropical island. But we had to be patient. We knew that. Those places are a long way away. It could take days, even months. Until after what seemed like hours and hours and hours and hours, we decided to eat our rations, which I divided up equally. I gave Midge all the rum, and I had all the biscuits. Looking back on it now, that probably wasn't a good idea, especially for Midge. What with the rolling of the ship, and not having had any breakfast, and the excitement, and a couple of swigs of rum, and... Well, you guess what happened? All over the place. We pulled back the sheet and decided to give ourselves up. We climbed down onto the deck, and as Midge staggered up to the nearest rail, I looked out to sea, hoping to catch sight of a whale or a shoal of dolphins, perhaps see the coast of America looming into view. And what did I see? The Liver buildings. Well, I mean, anyone can make a mistake, can't they? I mean, we weren't to know we'd stowed away on a ferry boat. One that goes from Liverpool to Birkenhead and back again, to-ing and fro-ing across the River Mersey. We'd done four trips hidden in the lifeboat and ended up back in Liverpool. And we'd only been away an hour and a half. We got the bus home. My mum and dad were having their breakfast. Aye, aye, said my dad. Here comes the early bird. What have you been up to then? I ran away to sea, I said. That's nice, said Mum, shaking out the cornflakes. That's nice.
Roger McGough will be reading from his books, as will many other well-known authors, as part of Children's Book Week, which started yesterday. You'll find details of where they're going around the country in your library or local bookshop. Two of the authors involved in Book Week, Dick King-Smith and Anne Pilling, have now joined us. Dick, you've just had a paperback published, George Speaks. What's it about?
It's a little book about a very little boy. He is a baby born with powers of comprehension and language, and at 4 weeks old, he talks extremely well. He has an older sister called Laura, who is absolutely amazed at this, of course, although it is a secret between them at George's bidding.
Dick, that sounds intriguing. Let's hear your favourite part of the book.
Laura didn't get a chance to be alone with George before bedtime, but she spent the whole night, it seemed, dreaming about him. In one of these dreams, she took him to school with her and carried him into assembly. Laura, said the headmaster, that child is far too young to come to school. But, sir, said Laura, he's very intelligent. Intelligent, is he? Said the headmaster, while all the children laughed. I suppose he knows his tables. Of course, Laura said. The headmaster leant down towards the baby who was sitting on Laura's lap. Well, young man, he said, perhaps you could tell me the answer to this. What's 3 times 9? 27, said George. He looked scornfully at the headmaster. I wouldn't have expected you to know that, he said. When Laura woke up next morning and remembered that dream, it seemed fantastic. Fantastic to think that a tiny baby could do sums, or talk, for that matter. Was that all a dream? What she thought had happened yesterday? I must make sure, she said, and she jumped out of bed. Peeping round the door of George's room, she saw that he was alone. George, she said softly, it's me, Laura. Listen, George, What's 3 times 9? George smiled at her and waved his fat little hands. Goo, goo, he said, goo, goo, goo. Laura's face crumpled. It had all been a dream. Then she burst into tears. Oh, come on, Laura, said George testily. Don't be such a baby. Oh, George, cried Laura, the tears running down her face. She bent over and kissed the top of his bald head. I thought, she said, I thought. I know what you thought, said George. Can't you take a joke? And do stop crying on me. It's bad enough being wet at the bottom end.
I really don't think I could cope with a baby brother like George. Anne Pilling's books are for older children. Anne, can you tell us about your latest paperback, Stan?
I wanted to write a thriller because I like thrillers. I'm going to read just the end of it, but this doesn't give the game away. At the end of his long and horrific journey from London to the north, across the sea to Ireland, Stan eventually reaches his goal, which is a little farm in the south of Ireland. But it isn't quite as he imagined. The yard was paved with white concrete slabs. In the crumbs of soil between the squares, something had taken root. A clump of nameless weeds, yellow-green and shriveled, stood up strongly against the wind. It was October already, and they would die off soon. But in early spring, they would come again. A line of green, then a few shoots, and at last another tiny thicket that would bud and flower and scatter its seeds. They had survived, pushing up strongly through the concrete slabs into the light and the rain. Stan looked at the small shoots. He also would endure, like them.
Anne, thank you. Roger, were you into thrillers, or what sort of thing did you read as a child?
Think back to my childhood. I don't remember reading many books when I was young, very young. I remember... My mum used to read to me, I remember. It was Enid Blyton I liked. I think of Enid Blyton, I think of the Famous Five and the Seven and whatever. But I also remember Enid Blyton poems. I mean, the first poem I learned to recite, which I haven't been able to trace since I was young, about her bouncing a big rubber ball, red rubber ball in the garden.
That sounds fun. I don't know that one. What about you, Dick? What sort of books were your favourites?
I liked books about talking animals, and I write books about talking animals now, I'm afraid. I'm jolly glad that when I was little I read masses of Beatrix Potter and A.A. Milne and Kenneth Graham and all those people who wrote about talking animals. I think probably the best children's story I've ever read was Kipling. I doubt anybody's going to beat the adventures of Mowgli and Baloo and Bagheera and Kaa, the rock python and the Bandar Log. Wonderful stuff.
Yes, it is. Anne, if you had to choose your top children's book, what would it be?
Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, and it's about a spider who saves the life of a pig. The pig is the runt of the litter, and it's fattened up, and it's going to market, and it's the pet of a little girl called Fern. And Charlotte, the spider who lives in the barn, decides to save the pig, whose name is Wilbur. And I think it's a wise, funny, reassuring book.
Yes, Charlotte's Web's a favourite modern classic, and thanks for joining us, all of you. Hope you have a marvellous book week. My favourite books were Anthony Buckeridge's ones about Jennings and Derbyshire. What were yours, Adrian?
Well, a few of the authors there mentioned A.A. Milne and Enid Blyton, and A.A. Milne's Now We Are Six is one of my favourites, one of my first ones, and then Enid Blyton's Secret Seven, and in the end I got round to The Hobbit, so they're a couple of my favourites.
Yeah, mine too. Why don't you write in and tell us about your top three favourite books, and don't forget to add the authors and your own name and address, because we'll be sending stickers and bookmarks to everyone who writes in. Let's make our own Cat's Whiskers Top 10.
Now time to hear from Bill Torrance on the Cat's Whiskers Castle Trail. Follow the trail for the next 6 weeks and you could win a British Airways flight to Scotland in a family weekend in Stonefield Castle. Also, there are Cat's Whiskers Carrier More rucksacks for the 5 runners-up. So let's join Bill in the Big Budgie for the first clue.
Talking to you from my helicopter, Bill's Budgie, on the first lap of the CWCT, the Cat's Whiskers Castle Trail. Now I'm heli-hopping around Britain, stopping off at a different castle each week. I hope you've got pencils and papers ready, because here we go. Come on, Budgie, you can do it. Come on. I'm crossing north of the border now, flying up the coast. This side of the country, of course, has far fewer islands than on the other side. Mind you, we've passed several castles and fortresses dotted all the way up. And right now I've got a fantastic view looking down on the first castle in our competition. So when I find somewhere to land, or should I say, perch the budgie, I'll meet you in the castle courtyard. I'm now standing in the courtyard of an old ruined castle, looking out towards, well, I suppose the next place you'd come to out there would be Norway or Sweden. Anyway, here's your clue. Round three sides, the ocean flows. In red stone ruins, the grass now grows. From the Earls of Douglas to a royal stronghold, go forth to find this castle old. I'll give it to you again. Round three sides, the ocean flows. In red stone ruins, the grass now grows. From the Earls of Douglas to a royal stronghold, go forth to find this castle old. Got the clue down? Now, all you have to do is work out where I am. And next week, I'll be crossing the border to the south. Or some might call it the north. Hope you'll join me. Come on, Tweety Pie. Time to fly. Come on. Cheery bye.
Now, if you'd like to join Bill on the castle trail, then write to us at Cat's Whiskers for an entry form. The address is at the end of the programme.
And here's a hint from us. The castle is mentioned in the Cat's Whiskers magazine. It's one of the places you can get in free as a club member. And the clues will also be printed each week in the new magazine, Fast Forward.
Our birthday guest this week holds the world record for the mile. He is Olympic athlete Steve Cram. Welcome to the programme, Stephen. Happy birthday for next Saturday.
Thank you very much.
How did you start running?
Well, I guess like a lot of youngsters, I was very keen in all sports, and I found that the soccer season finished in, May time or something, and the teacher at school started getting us out running around the track, and I found I was reasonably good at actually running 400 metres, not 1500 metres at the time, and I ran a couple of races for the school. This was about age, I guess, 12, something like that, and the guy who was the local coach at the athletic club, Jimmy Headley, who's become my coach right through my career, he saw me running for the school and asked me to go and join the athletic club, and it just went on from there.
So you've had the same coach for like nearly 19 years now then?
Yeah, athletics is pretty much based around people like Jimmy who run the local clubs, and they're the sort of club coach, and they go around looking for youngsters at school meetings and things, and then they try and sort of bring them through.
Going back to when you were younger, did you have any other sports that you were particularly interested in?
Well, as most people probably know, I was a mad soccer fan, and I would dearly have loved to have been a football player. And football is such a strong tradition in this area that I would have dearly have loved to have made it, but I wasn't any good. And I remember Jimmy coming to watch me one Saturday morning when I was about 13 or 14 and playing for the school, and I came off and hadn't had a particularly good game, I must say. And Jimmy said, look, son, give it a miss, you're better off sticking to running. And so I did. It was a hard decision to make when you're that age, because you so much enjoy especially team sport, because athletics is an individual sport,
right.
But I replaced that with basketball actually after that, and I played basketball for until I was about 17, 18, and we had a very, very successful school team. We were county champions, and that sort of replaced the team sport element.
Right, you've had a lot of success in the past. Do you still find yourself ambitious? Do you still want more success?
I've been lucky enough to have been very successful in the sport, but you're always striving to improve and to look for new challenges. And it seems as though I've been around for an awful long time, but I'm still only 28 or coming up to 29 with this birthday looming, and I still consider that to be reasonably young, and I think I've still got a lot to offer in the athletic arenas around the world.
So talking about your birthday, how will you be spending it this year?
Well, I think I may well decide to have a pretty big celebration this time. The last year of my 20s, this thing about 30 looming up in the distance.
It's worrying.
It's very, very worrying, I must admit. I've had one or two funny birthdays. Probably the worst one was, I think, when I was 21, actually, was coming back from the Commonwealth Games in Brisbane. We set off, actually, on my birthday, on the 14th, to fly home. And with the time difference, it meant that my birthday lasted about 36 hours, I think. Unfortunately, I had a touch of glandular fever and wasn't feeling too well, so everybody on the aeroplane celebrated for me. And I was sipping orange juice while everyone was getting heavily into the celebrations. And I was feeling very ill when I finally arrived back in Newcastle after a very long journey, only to find that my mum and dad had planned a surprise party. A very long birthday, that one.
Do you have a piece of favourite music that we can play on your birthday?
Well, a piece of corny music, if you like. It's Born to Run, which is a Bruce Springsteen song, but I prefer the version by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which is on the Welcome to the Pleasure Dome album.
Happy birthday to club members this week. John Allen, Florence McKerney, Hannah Gregory and Thomas Patterson.
Adam Heath, Lee Collins, Joanna Odds and Nicola Chin.
Hannah Druitt, Jonathan Williams, Owen Thomas and Hannah Coulson.
Club members Alison Spohr, Joan Goulburn, Laura Wynne and Tamsin Lane.
Jack Gray, Rachel Penfold, Oliver Bunting and Leonie Price.
Inez Lopez, Katie Armstrong, Andrew Darby and Hannah Reynolds.
Happy birthday to Jack Nichols, Sally Stott, Daniel Clinch and Gavin Rolfe.
Bill Gold, Holly Lamming, Sally Tipping and Helen McDougall.
And lastly to Willow Hewitt, Rebecca Small, Matthew White, Oliver Merrick and Claire Wright.
Happy birthday to everyone sharing a birthday with Steve Crown.
Here's Victoria Wood now with episode 2 of The Last Vampire, The Hollins Meet the Locals.
The sun rose early, bathing the mountaintop in a rosy hue. Even the castle Alucard had lost its cold, forbidding appearance of the night before. Albert Hollins hummed to himself as he steered the car out through the crumbling gateposts at the edge of the pine forest and set off, driving carefully, up the winding mountain road. He left his wife Emily and son Henry behind to their own devices at the campsite to go off exploring on his own. The road, he discovered, went right through the heart of a busy mountain village. He parked the car in the cobbled market square. At one corner was a little general shop with a low door. The shop's window was full of long, thin, cooked sausages, hanging on strings, and all sizes and shapes of cheese. Albert pushed the door open and walked inside. Another door behind the high black counter creaked open and the shopkeeper appeared. He looked Albert up and down, wiped his hands on a dishcloth, and beamed genially. "Good morning, sir." "Good heavens," said Albert. "You speak English?" "Ah, yes, sir. We have visitors from all over the world passing through the village. And in which direction are you heading, sir? Up the mountain or down?" "Neither," said Albert. "As a matter of fact, I'm thinking of stopping over in the district for a day or two." He paused and pointed at a large round red cheese that took his fancy. "Do you think I might have half a kilo of that?" he asked. "Of course, sir," said the shopkeeper, placing the cheese on a board and picking up a long, sharp knife. "Stopping over, eh? Looking for lodgings, are you?" "No, no, no," said Albert. "I'm not looking for accommodation. I'm here on a camping holiday with my wife, Emily, and my son. We've got a tent, and we found an ideal spot to set up camp." "Have you indeed, sir?" said the shopkeeper. "And where might that be?" "Just down the road, a mile or so, and through a forest, we found a quite delightful secluded spot. We've pitched our tent by the Castle Alucard. Do you happen to know the place by any—" Albert broke off in some surprise as the shopkeeper's knife dropped from his grasp and clattered noisily onto the flagstone floor. "Is anything the matter?" said Albert. The shopkeeper made no reply but turned and scuttled through the door behind the counter. There was the sound of a key turning in a rusty lock, and then there was silence. Albert waited, patiently, for several minutes. Then, deciding he was not staying there to be made a fool of, he turned and walked out briskly. Back at the tent, Emily Hollins tapped the top of the corned beef can and the slab of meat slid out effortlessly onto the bright red plastic plate. She smiled to herself as she diced the corned beef into small squares. Suddenly, Emily got the curious feeling that she was not alone. She glanced up. A huge Alsatian dog, the biggest she'd ever seen, was standing no more than a few yards away from where she was working, growling at her menacingly. Emily stared at the wolf, for wolf it was, although she didn't realise it. The wolf stared back at Emily. "Good doggy," said Emily. In reply, the wolf splayed its front feet, lowered its head, drew back its upper lip, and showed her an ugly set of gleaming teeth. snarled the wolf. Naughty dog, said Emily. As a child, she'd owned a poodle, and so she'd grown up with no fear of dogs at all. Who's a naughty, naughty dog, then? Who's a bad, bad boy for growling at Auntie Emily? The wolf was somewhat taken aback. It threw back its head and let out a terrifying howl. It occurred to Emily at last what was the matter with the animal. Oh, diddums then, is the little doggy-woggy hungry? Does the little doggy-woggy's cruel master at the castle not give him enough to eat? With which she picked up one of the cubes of corned beef and held it temptingly above her head. Catch, boy! Emily tossed the cube of corned beef towards the wolf, which caught it neatly and swallowed it at a gulp. Here, boy! Good boy! Emily held up another cube of corned beef. Who's a clever dog, then? The wolf could hardly believe its good fortune. The poor thing didn't look as if it had enjoyed a good meal in years. She resolved, give the entire contents of the tin of corned beef to the dog. Good dog, good boy, said Emily, as the wolf sniffed at the ground and licked up the last crumbs of meat that had fallen from its mouth. Emily crossed from behind the table and held out a hand to stroke the wolf. Who's a good boy, then? Who's a clever man? She said encouragingly. But the wolf had some natural pride and dignity. It certainly wasn't going to stand around while the strange, fearless person prodded at it. The wolf turned and slunk off the way it had come, into the shelter of the pine forest. In the village police station, Sergeant Alphonse Croppertel stared out of the iron-barred window across the cobbled square. You're sure that's what he said, Eric? Demanded the sergeant. The shopkeeper, whose name was Eric Horowitz, nodded firmly. Definitely, Sergeant. The Castle Alucard, he said. I heard him with my own ears. Sergeant Croppertel stroked his beard and sucked in his cheeks. The Castle Alucard, he said. But why would anyone in her right mind go anywhere near that place? Is he travelling alone? The shopkeeper shook his head. He's got his family with him, or so he says, his wife and son. And what are they doing there, I'd like to know? What was the stranger up to? Well, whatever foul deed the stranger had in mind, Croppertel would foil his evil plans. Albert's son Henry had set off to walk round the Castle Alucard for the fourth time that morning. He was sure that there was a vampire hiding somewhere inside the castle. Who else had been playing the violin the night before? Henry found a narrow doorway in a dark corner of the courtyard, which led into a cold, damp, stale-smelling cellar. And from there, two flights of worn stone steps took him into a circular room filled with antique furniture. Henry also discovered a small table, on which there stood an old-fashioned wind-up gramophone with an enormous horn and a pile of dusty old records. He was just about to leave the room when he noticed the piece of scarlet-lined black cloth that was wedged in the wardrobe door. Someone was hiding in the wardrobe. Henry gulped twice. What should he do next? As he stood there undecided, the wardrobe door was pushed open slowly from inside. I hope you realize you're trespassing on private property. The man who spoke and who had just stepped out of the wardrobe was tall, thin, and had a long, pale face with a sad expression. He wore a black suit and a starched white shirt with a black bow tie, and over his shoulders a scarlet-lined black cloak. There could be no mistaking his identity.
Well, I think we all know who that is.
Ah, but don't worry. It seems like Henry and his family can handle anything, as you'll hear next week.
We'll also be announcing the winners of last week's Spamchester Mystery, and we'll give you another chance to play Super Sleuth in the Spamchester Soccer Shocker.
Our birthday guest is radio and television presenter Timmy Mallett. Till then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
And the address for your favourite books in the Treasure Trail entry form is Cat's Whiskers, BBC, PO Box 40, Manchester M60 1FR. Cat's Whiskers was presented by Julie First and Adrian Morehouse. The researcher was Liz Roberts, and the programme was produced in Manchester, Maryam.